This podcast is brought to you by Intrepid Travel, the global leaders in immersive, sustainable, small group travel experiences. Take yourself away from the world you know and be open, curious, fearless, and challenged. Be Intrepid. Visit intrepidtravel.com to book your next trip today. Here's the thing about the Australian Outback. It's big. It's really, really big. It's probably bigger than even most Australians would realise. This is an area that covers more than 80% of the country. That's more than 6 million square kilometres. An area twice the size of India, 10 times as big as France. And what's contained in that area is so much more diverse than many visitors initially believe. Yes, you'll find the classic red dirt and barren terrain that the outback is so commonly associated with, but you'll also find wetlands that stretch to the horizon. You'll find deep gorges and spectacular waterfalls. You'll find rugged mountain ranges, coastal woodlands, lush rainforests, and even beaches. In short, you'll find one of the most amazing places on the planet. And yet, how much of it have we discovered? Hi, I'm Ben Groundwater, and you're listening to Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast. Today we're talking about the Australian Outback, that almost mythical stretch of land that holds so much, and of which we know so little. Today we're going to investigate this amazing place. What is it? Where is it? What can you do there? Where can you go? And what do you have to avoid? Joining me to answer those questions are two experts on Australia's rugged interior. First up, she's a travel writer, editor, and influencer who dreams of the wildflowers of WA, Georgia Rickard. Hey, Georgia.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks for coming along. Also with us, she's the author of 5 books about the Outback and someone whose ideal accommodation is a swag under the stars, Sue Williams.
Hi, Sue. Ben.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me, guys. Now, have you guys been amazed at the diversity of the Outback? Because, you know, just writing that script, I was thinking there's so much more to the Outback than I really thought about.
Sure, absolutely. I think our idea of the Outback is probably all about the Simpson Desert, you know, those kind of wide brown plains and red sand dunes.
Uluru just as outside well,
Birdsville. Those kind of stereotypical ideas. And so much of the Outback is about those because there's lots of desert out there. But there's also, as you said in your intro, there's some amazing places. There's kind of Ningaloo out in Western Australia.
Yep.
There's the wetlands of Kakadu. There's just incredible variety. It's quite stunning. And I think because we all live on the outskirts of the country, we just don't go into the interior very much. And people in the interior who live in the outback don't see themselves reflected very often.
Right.
Really.
Yeah, interesting.
Which is actually nuts when you think about it, because the outback, as we've just very clearly clarified, is not just red dust and dirt, right? Like it's this incredible expanse. I mean, if you compare the size of Australia to the size of America and the fact that America is well known for having all these different kinds of environments, Australia has just as many different kinds of environments in its outback. So really we should be getting in there, but I think this idea of the red dirt and the barrenness really turns a lot of us off, which is just, you know, it's a fault of our own marketing. Silly us.
And I think like a lot of us have probably been to more than the outback than we realise, because you go to these places like, you know, you go to the Daintree or you go to, you know, Esperance in southern Western Australia, and these places that you would never actually think is the outback, but there you are.
Yes. And I think that says, which brings me to one of my favourite topics, which is actually defining the outback. And it's one of my favourite topics because I actually went on quite an investigative hunt looking for the appropriate definition of how you actually define the outback. Because, you know, typically, I guess, or the term comes from outback, right? It was outback.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it is this nebulous sort of term that doesn't really have any proper boundaries, or I don't know what it is really.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I suppose in today's day and age, in that case, maybe the outback really only exists in places where there's no mobile reception. But there are several.
Mind you, Birdsville, you get fabulous mobile reception. Fantastic internet. Better than in my home in the centre of Sydney.
They've probably got NBN, haven't they?
They do.
I knew it.
Stop it. But I mean, no, yeah, look, there's so many different there's so much confusion, which is such a shame, particularly amongst Australians. Wikipedia tries to say that it's vast, remote and arid areas of Australia, which isn't true because half the outback is actually tropical.
Yeah.
And as you said before, there's rainforests and wetlands and savannas and the dictionary, the Collins Dictionary, says it's parts of Australia that are far from towns.
Right. So, which is going to anger a fair few people.
Yeah. Though, sorry, Alice Springs.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the official definition of outback is what the Australian government calls our range lands. And that is actually, if you Google it, it's 81% of Australia. And if you took a map of Australia, it's basically just cut out most of the east coast of Oz and then draw a line from Sydney across to Perth, and basically everything south of there just about isn't considered outback, but everything north is. And that is a huge percentage of our continent.
I mean, absolutely.
81%, as I said.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you kind of talk to locals about how they define their outback. And often
are they proud of the fact that they live in the outback, do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because they'll say, oh, in the outback, everybody waves. You know, when you're kind of passing a car, everybody will wave to you. And in the city, obviously, people will put two fingers up, that kind of thing. So,
I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
How do you drive, Sue?
And I actually think one of the best definitions I've ever heard was from a local in South Australia who said, you know when you're in the outback when the handshake is a little firmer and the smile lingers longer. And I just thought that was absolutely gorgeous. I love that.
Very poetic as well. Mm. We're going to talk a bit about bush poetry later on. But yeah, there is. And again, Georgia, I guess the human element to the outback is something that is not really spoken about that much, I guess. But it seems to be a really big draw for some people.
Yeah. I mean, look, not on any of my trips have I ever gone to, parts of the outback expecting that I would walk away going, yeah, the people were the real highlight. But inevitably or invariably, I was recently in Outback WA and we were in a one street town and, you know, standing out in the street admiring the unbelievable stars that you can see above. And about 50 Ks away, there was a raging bushfire that had sprung up as a result of the lightning.
Yeah.
And this was only maybe, a couple of months ago. And we were just staring at it, and I could see the locals were looking at this bushfire and they were thinking, and they said out loud, look, if that starts moving in our direction, we're going to have to think seriously about mobilising. Yeah. And I think it's when you're out quite remote, you have to be a lot more responsible for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that responsibility translates to a willingness to put up with a lot more discomfort. Not just physically, but also in social situations.
Oh, yeah.
And so, whereas in the city we might be more likely to avert our eyes or kind of keep to ourselves, in the outback there's very much more a willingness to be open and look you in the eyes, as you say, Sue, shake a hand firmly and engage in conversation and really.
Does that also manifest in this idea that, people don't suffer fools gladly out there? Oh. You know, if you're making a goose of yourself, someone will tell you.
it's pretty no nonsense and it's not loving.
Yeah.
Mm. It's the way it's got to be.
Yeah.
Because people will be very friendly because there are far fewer people to choose from, I think. So you kind of have to be friendly with more of them. Whereas
I guess you have to try and see the good side of people, don't you, if you're going to be stuck with them.
Absolutely, yeah. You can't get away from them because they're only the only people around in the last 1,000 kilometres square.
Right.
You've got to kind of get on with them, yeah.
So was this an intimidating place for you to first go to? Because you're not from Australia and even for Australians, the outback seems like a fairly intimidating place.
Sure. No, it really was at first because in many ways, I'm the worst possible person to go to the outback because I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't eat meat, I don't eat wheat, I'm gluten intolerant, I don't even drink tea or coffee because I can't take the caffeine.
No.
So, in lots of ways, I was very much a fish out of water and I've always lived in cities. So the outback was a very foreign place to me. And the first time I went, I remember thinking, oh my God, this is awful.
Where was your first destination?
I think the first place I ever went to was Broken Hill.
Right, okay.
And, you just go outside of this town of Broken Hill and you kind of look out there and there's just this vast horizon. There's nothing there, just flies and dirt. And you kind of think, there is nothing. But the next time I went out there, it was 15 years later and it was quite bizarre. I was walking down the street and this man said hello to me. He said, hi, Sue. And he remembered me from all those years ago.
Oh, wow.
That is amazing. I just thought
that was quite incredible. And then when I went and looked at the same view, I thought, wow, this is so beautiful. I think your mind, you kind of get used to it. It's a bit scary at first because it's such huge spaces and there's, not very much to interrupt it.
Yeah.
But once you've kind of come to terms with it, you can really see the beauty there, I think. You really start appreciating.
Yeah, it's obviously fired a real passion in you. If you've written 5 books about it now,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no. And I mean, I'm still not terribly at home in the outback, But I really love it, and I really envy the people who are at home.
Yeah,
and I have lots of friends out there now who really give me a hand.
Yeah,
getting through.
Georgia, what is the outback to you? What's the sort of picture that you get in your mind when you think about this place?
That is such a hard question, and I don't think that I can.
Is it
give
just
you...
too diverse to possibly do that?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the outback to me. It's quite a, I don't want to sound all woo-woo, but it is quite a spiritual kind of place,
yeah.
Right? Because there's so much space and so much opportunity to just sit in peace. But, you know, it's road tripping through all of the interior roads of Australia that really aren't even sealed. There's so much of our country that's just still dirt roads.
Yeah.
It's swimming in, you know, gorges that are a billion years old, where there's not a single person in sight.
Yeah. It's,
only crocs.
Yeah, no. But there's so many gorges around Australia, and you know, in WA and in the NT that are croc free. So it's important to actually, you know, obviously you want to make sure that you're swimming in the croc free ones. But there's plenty of.
I just remember being in the Kimberley and looking in this piece of water and thinking I'd love to jump in there, and suddenly seeing a shark come out and then a crocodile. Attack the shark.
Oh my god.
Who won?
The crocodile.
Really? Okay,
yeah.
There you go.
Absolutely.
That answers the age old question.
Peak Australia.
Yes, absolutely.
You win.
But do you think exploring the outback, does it give you a real, a much better idea of Australia and what this place means? And in particular, I mean, to Aboriginal people as well, because you must be exposed to a lot more Aboriginal culture there than you would in the cities.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's really sad, I think, in lots of cities, we just don't see Aboriginal people around and we don't get to meet them and talk to them and kind of share in their culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go to Bangarra and you can go to lots of cultural events, but it's not the same as actually meeting regular Aboriginal people.
No. Yeah.
But out in the outback, you know, you can kind of meet with them, you can talk with them. They're often very, very generous about showing you their lands. I went out with a group of Aboriginal women to Maralinga, to their ancestral lands in outback South Australia, and they danced and sang their lands for me. And it was just such a moving experience.
Yeah.
It was just quite incredible.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the best experiences of my life out there.
Yeah,
I
mean, it's such a different perspective on this country that, you know, you've lived in for a long time, I've grown up in, but you don't really have that connection to country that Aboriginal people do.
No,
and you also don't have that exposure to their relationship with it.
Quite. And it really showed for me the division between city and country, because I went out with them and they asked me to bring out the food. So I brought salad sandwiches, being a vegetarian, and they were expecting a kangaroo leg that they could throw onto the fire. So they were very disappointed. And they were also very disappointed in my driving across the sand. I was the only one with a driving license, but they took the steering wheel away from me because they said I was so useless. So, and it was really interesting. But then when I travelled with one of them, the daughter of one of the elderly women up from Sydney, we sat in the plane and she put her cup up to the air flow on the top and because she thought that was a coffee machine. So it's actually really funny seeing this kind of division between us, really, the two cultures.
Right.
Not quite meeting, but kind of laughing at each other's, you know, different expectations.
Yeah.
So it was fun.
I actually, you know, one of the key experiences that's really allowed me to come to grips with the Aboriginal heritage of Australia was going, you know, really remote around the Kimberley and spending a fair few days before coming across some very remote art. And, you know, rock art painted on the inside of this beautiful cave, right at the very top northwestern tip of Australia. But by the time I made it there, I'd spent a few days out of, you know, normal city life.
Yeah.
And so that allowed me, I think, to feel a little bit closer to, you know, the Indigenous experience.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I can't speak on behalf of what it was like for them, but just even that small insight had just really left me with a much deeper sense of respect, I suppose.
Yeah. And then, of course, when you're in the outback and in these small towns, you experience another type of culture, which is sort of Australia's country culture, which, again, if you're in a city, you don't have that much of a relationship with, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you ended up in a boxing tent in a...
Yes, I am.
Talk us through this. How does this happen?
Yeah, well, I kind of thought it'd be really interesting to write about Fred Brophy's boxing tent, which is the last outback boxing tent still in existence.
Right.
And it's been outlawed in most places in Australia because it's so dangerous, but it's still allowed in outback Queensland and Northern Territory.
So what, this is just people who roll up and take on the champion, do
That's
they?
That's right.
For a
prize. So they have maybe five professional boxers, yeah. and then they have volunteers who will volunteer right. to fight them. So I was kind of talking to Fred on the phone saying, can I come up and have a chat to you and your boxers? And then kind of I didn't realise I was speaking out loud, but I said, oh, maybe I'll have a fight myself. And he said, oh, don't be ridiculous. How old are you? And I said how old I was. And he said, and have you fought before? And I said, well, no. And he said, well, you can't possibly fight. So at that point I That's thought, it. Yes, I can.
It's locked in.
So I spent 2 weeks travelling, going out to different boxing gyms to try and pick up the basics.
No.
And then went up there. And it was actually my birthday, and it was the worst birthday I've ever had in my life, really. And I fought a woman called the Beaver, who ended up, I discovered later, she was she'd just been the runner-up in the Queensland Middleweight Championship.
Wow.
So she was
she's serious.
Yeah, she was a big woman too.
Right.
She was very scary. But once I'd kind of committed myself, once I'd volunteered and I'd been accepted, then you can't actually back out.
Right.
Oh,
so you
dear.
All file into
you must
this
have
outback
had the crowd
boxing
behind
tent.
You, wouldn't you?
Well, absolutely, because I was so clearly the underdog. Yeah, I was pathetic. But, you know, you kind of – you commit yourself and you kind of there, and we started our fight, 200 people around us, because you're just boxing on sawdust. There's no ring or anything.
Yeah.
They're all shouting and most of them shouting for me.
That's amazing
nice.
That this still happens.
Yeah.
And,
no,
that's
yeah.
amazing
right.
that you,
you were
happened.
Involved as
yeah.
well.
What, so what happened?
It wasn't very nice. Well, right at the very beginning, she came at me with a really strong cross and it hit me really firmly
wow.
on the jaw.
So she wasn't messing around.
No,
she
no, was, no, yeah. no. So I went down and everything went black and I thought, thank God I've been knocked out. It's all over. But then the lights flickered back on and there's had a power
the
cut.
The fact you had that conscious thought meant that
no,
you
that's
were,
right.
you were
exactly.
not knocked out.
I think it was just hopeful. So the generator had failed. So they started again. And we had to fight again. So it was just three rounds of a minute a round and you're kind of fighting and you're covered in blood and you're thinking, oh, maybe it's her blood. And then you're thinking, no, I think it's coming out of me really. And
my
you just carry
God.
On. And
did you have headgear on or anything?
No, you're not allowed to have.
Wow.
Yeah, that's,
how
that's
was
the thing
without, afterwards?
It didn't look too great, but I didn't break anything, which was really good. I think I was quite fortunate.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's so funny because the crowd was shouting so much for me and I got so much in the moment. But at the end, Fred says, and the winner is, and he holds both our hands, and I thought, oh, maybe I've won. But of course, no chance.
Yeah.
So they held up her hand, and the Beaver won. But it was interesting because afterwards, all these guys came up to me, and they were kind of quite scary people because they were all really tattooed. And one guy had a bald head, a tattoo, yep. tattoos yep. all over his head, and leathers, and lots of bikies there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them said, shake my hand, you've got more balls than most of the men here. And he shook my hand really hard, really hurt. And he said, I'll buy you a beer. And I said, I'll have a lemonade. So that was my moment.
They can't have seen anything like you before, surely.
No, and they never probably will again.
That is amazing. Well done you.
But it gave me a certain kind of standing when I went back into the outback because people would say to me, oh, you're just a city person. And yeah. I'd say, well, when I was fighting in Fred Brophy's tent, they'd say, oh, you yeah. had a fight. Suddenly yeah, right. I had status. I had profile. I had respect. So it served me well in the end. It was worth the pain
that
and the bruises.
Great.
Don't you find that so much of – like I feel like that summarizes so much about the outback because once you kind of get out of the cities, there are just no rules.
Let's talk about the characters that you know. You're saying there's some fairly rough people in there. You must – out in the outback, you must meet – you know, obviously there's the sort of salt of the earth people who lived out there, but there's obviously there's, you know, sort of people who are getting away from certain circumstances as well.
Oh,
there
are so many people running from the law. I am quite
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, sure.
You know, in fact, speaking of characters, I think the place that has the highest ratio of character to regular humans, probably, you know, on Earth, right. they've got to be up there for a top contender, would have to be the Northern Territory.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And, you know, it's just every second person is larger than life. You know, they
yep.
– if anyone from the NT is listening, what is with all the personalised number plates? Seriously?
I've never seen more personalised plates in my life.
They love it.
Yeah, they really
it's
do.
Just
you never have to ask anyone's name because it's plastered on the front of
yeah.
their
yeah.
U.
That's right.
That's Macca, obviously. Macca Bravo.
Then there's also areas like Cooper Pedy or Lightning Ridge where there's kind of amazing characters as well and they're all kind of going under the radar. Nobody
yeah.
wants to know.
Well, literally. Yep. Oh, yeah, because Cooper Pedy's official population is something like 2,000, but
yep.
it's a lot higher than that,
sure.
right? It's a
yeah,
place you
right.
go if you don't
yep.
want to be found.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's kind of the Northern Territory and then all these other little places as well, I think. Yeah.
definitely the interior. I actually, when I was up in the Kimberley a couple of years ago, I was road tripping through the Gibb River Road, and I'll never forget meeting a gentleman in one of the campsites, and he was deadly serious, like, you know, very committed to what he was telling me. And he said that he had built a trap for minor birds in his backyard.
Right.
And that very seriously and very proudly, he told me that he himself personally had trapped and killed over 480 minor birds.
God,
this
that's
year.
Weird.
That's worrying on several levels.
I mean, it is, and yet, you know, he's
I mean,
just,
they do destroy native wildlife.
He's, yeah, yeah, he's yeah. taking matters
he's
into
fighting,
his
he's
own
fighting
hands.
A good fight. I don't
that's
know if it's
right.
one that I would necessarily get involved in.
That's but. Right. And yeah. Yeah, I got told a similar story quite recently at a pub in WA by what she must – her name is Margaret, and she must be up there for the title of Australia's oldest barmaid. She's 78.
Mm-hmm.
And she tends bar every night faithfully at the Kakini Grand Hotel. And my God, that woman has some stories. But, you know, and can serve a beer, I will say.
There you go.
Hi, Margaret.
Get a taste for Australia on a small group adventure with Intrepid Travel. With trips covering the iconic spots like the Great Barrier Reef in Queensland, Uluru in the Red Centre and the Bungle Bungles in the Kimberley, there's no shortage of sights to see. With expert guides, First Nations experiences, unique accommodation, and responsible travel at the heart of each departure, a trip with Intrepid is the best way to explore down under. Find your perfect trip at intrepidtravel.com/Australia.
Has anything ever gone particularly wrong for you guys out in the outback? As, you know, Sue, you were mentioning a story where there were some bush mice on a plague in Larapinta, which doesn't sound ideal.
No, I did the Larapinta trek through the McDonnell Ranges outside Alice Springs.
Which is one of the classic hikes, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's very, very beautiful at some times of the year. But in the winter, it's very, very cold.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the year I went, there was a plague of bush mice. So there were tiny little furry bush mice.
That does not sound good to me.
It sounds kind of cute.
Well, they're kind of cute, but they're kind of like cockroaches because they scurry everywhere. So their cuteness is hampered by, you know, their size and by the number of them, really.
And, I mean, if there's plague proportions, I'm not going to be
and because
about
they got inside your tent, they got inside your swag, they got inside your rucksack, they ate the food, they bit
now,
through
Georgia?
The plastic, they, you know, they drank your water.
Right.
So it was really quite horrible. And one of the guys said to me, no, what you do is you just stamp on them. And I thought, I'm not going to stamp on a poor little mouse. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. He said, okay, what you do every night, take a sleeping pill, and then when they nest in your hair, they won't disturb you. What?
Time to get out the boots.
Yeah, exactly. So
was that a drop bear type story, or was he being serious?
No, he was being serious. Yeah. And later on the Larapinta trek, we actually met a guy, an Irish guy, who was sitting on the side of the path in tears because he'd lost all his water, he'd lost all his food to the bush mice, and he just couldn't cope with them anymore. And he was just sitting sobbing, and we had to radio for a helicopter to come pick him up because he hadn't realised how remote the place was.
Right,
because
okay.
People from outside often don't.
Yeah.
And so they came and rescued him. So, you know, I didn't quite cry like that. So, yes.
Congratulations. Because there are a lot of Europeans that show up, you know, hire their Hyundai for a week and then expect that they'll just do Australia and be done. just like Europe. And it's a different –
I think most Europeans don't actually – they can't – fathom how isolated some parts of Australia are.
There's barely anywhere like it in the world, really, is
no,
it? So
no.
isolated.
Yeah.
Georgia, you learned not to wander around on salt lakes, salt pans, did you, during your outback experience?
You know, you asked the question if I'd ever had any, like, major issues in the outback, and I have, but they've all just been really stupid city kid mistakes, right? And so I feel like I'm not really sure.
Well, we can't blame the outback for this. Let's just clear that up now.
So in WA... there's an amazing art sculpture. It's one of the most remote art installations in the world. It's called Lake Ballard, and there are 51 sculptures that are just planted at various intervals all over this lake. And they're almost life-size human sculptures
of the local people,
that's right.
Right.
And so to go out there, you know, to this very remote place and walk around these salt flats for a couple of hours and just you know, come to grips with these sculptures, it's quite an amazing thing to experience. Mm-hmm. And I showed up with a couple of mates and we rolled out of the car and we'd come the afternoon before and there'd been a bit of rain. And so we thought, oh, you know, we'd walked around the salt flats, but they were quite muddy and we thought we'll come back tomorrow. And so we came back the next morning and, you know, we'd been already. So we're feeling pretty confident. We were only wearing thongs. Stepped out of the car, stepped onto the salt flats, and it was a totally different, you know, proposition today. The salt flats were white and crusted mm-hmm. over, and they were sparkling in the sun. And one of the boys said, "Oh God, look how beautiful they are! They're glittering, you know. It's like magic." And so we're walking out into the salt flats, and we got quite far out when suddenly the salt started to crack underneath our feet, mm-hmm. and it was the middle of summer, so it was already. Oh, I don't know, 40 degrees at 11 a.m. And as the salt started to crack and we started to sink, it became very clear to us via the gushing liquid hot mud that was suddenly all over our feet that what was happening underneath the salt was that the mud had been baking and it was excruciatingly hot. And we were stuck there. You know, we couldn't move because as soon as we took a step, first of all, you were going to de-plug your thong. So that was a danger. But the further we went, you know, the worse we were going to sink. But we couldn't backtrack either because, you know, we had a job to do. We were out there to take photographs. And, you know, I honestly have never laughed so hard. I nearly wet my pants. It was so funny watching the other two because I happened to have stronger thongs on than they did. Just watching them negotiate this, you know, because it was so hot. It was excruciating. Yeah. Anyway, there you go. Salt flats. That's my tip.
Let's talk briefly about a few destinations and experiences that people maybe wouldn't expect from the outback. Sue, you were talking about whale sharks and Ningaloo. Yeah. Over in Western Australia, which, you know, to me is so far from the outback experience. But
sure, I mean, it's just a valid an activity, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you've got these fabulous, amazing whale sharks, the largest mammals in the world, just lots and lots of them off the WA coast.
Yep.
And you go out in a little boat and they've got plane spotters looking overhead to see where they are and radioing down, telling you where to go. And that's just fantastic seeing those. They tell you to jump out of the boat, you go down there and you're kind of swimming with the whale sharks. And it's just quite a magic experience, and they come towards you with their mouths wide open. You think shit, but then obviously they're just vegetarian, so you're okay, right. Really. But they're just—they
wouldn't need another
incredible.
Vegetarian.
No, absolutely. They'd recognise me. But it was funny because when I was coming back from there, I was in a plane, and the person I was sitting next to used to work as a plane spotter.
Yeah,
and he once radioed down and said, "There's a whale shark. You know, he can get in the water." And everybody got in the water, and then he phoned back and said, "No, get out, out. Yeah, it's a great white." And he said he never did it again after that.
Whoops.
But I was glad I learned that on the way out. But he's not doing that anymore, so everybody else is safe to try it.
I love actually, you know, beaches, outback beaches really are. It's such an unexpected, oh, really, there's beaches in the outback? Of course there are. And I don't think that there is anything more life-affirming than stripping off all of your clothes, absolutely plunging into the sea on a beach there where there's no one around.
Yeah, Western Australia is ideal for that.
Oh, it's just exquisite. And it's, you know, and especially if you're in an area where you do have that red Pindan soil, and then that tends to be accompanied by pure white sand. And of course, then because of the sand being so white, the water is just bright aqua. And it's like you're in this hyper-coloured universe. Yeah. It's really
Kalbarri
just like
in Western Australia
else.
Is that they get all the red sand that's blown across from the desert that meets the white sand of the ocean and, you know, this beautiful clear water. It's incredible.
Incredible.
Yeah. And Georgia, we wanted to mention the wildflowers as well.
Oh, yes.
Which, I saw your videos and it's amazing. Like carpets of incredibly coloured flowers. Where in WA is it?
Yeah, look, I loathe to use the term carpets because it's so overused when you're describing these wildflowers.
So you're saying you don't like my descriptor?
Basically.
Yeah.
Look, they're scattered all across WA and they, as I found, I did a road trip last year from Perth up to Mount Augustus, which is twice the size of Uluru and remarkably similar in shape. It's actually the world's largest rock. And on the way up and on the way back, two different routes, there were all sorts of incredible wildflowers. So it's hard to say where they're going to be exactly, just pretty much all along the side of the road, although Coal Seam Conservation Park is an absolute highlight. And basically, what happens, it's the most exquisite phenomenon I have ever seen. The entire landscape gets blanketed in these flowers that are, you know, the size of 20-cent coins to 50-cent coins to almost the size of tennis balls in some cases, and they are so tightly clustered together that you can't see the ground, and they stretch for kilometres.
Wow.
And you can go and sit in the middle of them, you know, pink and yellow and orange and purple and red, and the smell is like nothing I have ever experienced. It was like being in a real live perfume ad. I actually,
wow,
I cried, and it's completely native. It's completely
yep.
natural.
Yep.
And why doesn't that receive as much publicity as cherry blossoms in Japan? Yeah, it really
that's
should.
A good point.
Well, only yep. because you know, I think Western Australia is really, I mean, and like so much of Australia, like so much of the outback, most people just don't know about it, and yep. the people that do know about it aren't exactly, you know, generally speaking, in the outback, the type yeah. of people that are going to go, hey, everybody, come.
Sure.
Come here.
And it's hard to get to, isn't it? Like, these places are remote. It's, you're not going to drive half an hour and there it is.
Yeah, that's true. You've got to work for it a bit. And, you know, to that point, I've sort of reached a place where, you know, you don't want to encourage the whole world to come to these beautiful places because they are just so yeah. fragile and precious. Yeah.
But the outback is so big, it can absorb a lot of people.
That's really, true.
Yeah, yeah. yeah.
And they need the money as well. Yeah. It's kind of nice. It would yeah. be nice to see some of these incredible attractions just get into their proper place, I
indeed.
Think, you know.
Indeed.
Mm. Guys, we are running out of time, sadly, but to finish up, maybe if you can share one sort of great experience or maybe a quirky experience or something that's been overlooked by people that they should really have in the outback to give them a good feel for the place.
Okay, well, I would recommend everybody go on a cattle drove.
Oh, yeah?
I wasn't so keen on it because I can't ride a horse
right.
without falling off many times. But if anybody can ride a horse, it's a fantastic
and
experience.
And something anyone's allowed to do, are
they? Yeah, something yep. you just pay some money yep. and you just
right.
go on a cattle drove.
Wow,
and you
that's
kind of,
great.
You have all these cows that run off and they say, now gallop after that cow. And you say, no, thank you. I'm
horse,
happy plodding along.
The horse says no.
But, yeah, then at night you all gather around the fire and the local outback people just start yarning and telling jokes and
yeah.
reciting amazing bush poetry. You know, they're all kind of talking of, you know, Snow, the man from Snowy River. There was movement at the station
yeah.
for the word had passed around. You know, all that kind of incredible
great
stuff.
Stuff yeah.
And when you're there under 1,000 stars shining down and a black night, it's just fantastic listening
yeah.
to that.
Yeah.
It just
amazing.
Makes your spine, all your feelings tingle. It's just incredible.
That's great. How about you, Georgia?
All right, I'm actually going to give two.
You always break the rules.
I know, but I am particularly passionate about this area. Okay,
yeah.
There's a place at the very, very tip of the Northern Territory.
Mm-hmm.
It's right actually very close to the most northern tip of the territory, and it's called Victoria Settlement, and you can only get there by crossing into Arnhem Land, then driving up the Coburg Peninsula. It's 400 kilometres away from the nearest sealed road, so you need a four-wheel drive. You get to this camp, then you jump in a boat, and you make your way to this place called Victoria Settlement. And this was the third place that Britain actually tried to settle in Australia. And it was only there from 1838 and until 1849.
Right.
And when you arrive, it's like basically the remnants of this town, right? So there's all these buildings or lots of rocks and whatever. And the hospital is by far the biggest building there because there was all this malaria and people just died,
right.
you know, just horrifically. But it's basically been forgotten about. So you're in this incredible, very remote location and you're really getting to terms with what it would have been like for the first, you know, settlers, white settlers who came here. And amazingly, there's also a bunch of old champagne bottles still there, completely discarded. Obviously, the British didn't have champagne, but they actually built a lookout there, looking out for any Dutchmen who were coming in to try and colonize.
Right.
And some French scientists sailed in and basically they invited them ashore and they swapped champagne for gin and they all had this party and the party remnants are still there on the
wow.
ground.
Wow.
I mean, it's just phenomenal and
yep.
it's just casually sitting there in the bush.
Yeah,
it's just nuts.
Yep.
So that and the other thing I would say, and this isn't really about anywhere in particular, but is you've got to spend some time doing outback pubs.
Yep.
Right? Like there's doesn't matter whether you're doing the big, ornate, amazing old ones that have the grand staircases and basically have been, you know, were rebuilt in the honour of the British who transplanted them out here, or whether you're just going to the, you know, the tin shed where beers are served from an esky,
right?
Because they exist too.
Yeah,
It's just the people that
good
you
way
meet.
To get in touch with local culture and local people.
Absolutely. Well, look, the pub is your castle, in these towns.
Yeah.
And you go into some of them and you think, this is weird. How comes I'm the only woman here? Oh, there are other women. Oh, they don't have any clothes on. This is interesting.
there's that too. But, you know, it's just, it's such a, there's every kind of pub out there. You know, one pub I went to recently, the Kokaini Grand Hotel, which has Australia's oldest barmaid, also has a horse that comes to its front door every single day at sunset. It comes to the saloon wanting dinner. I mean, where else do you get that?
Amazing.
Hashtag Australia.
That's good stuff. And my tip would be over in Kalbarri, which I mentioned in sort of about central Western Australia on the coast there, there's a local Aboriginal guy there called Capes, Darren Capewell, and he runs day tours and actually does overnight experiences as well. And I find it's a really great way to sort of get in touch with what country means to the local Aboriginal people. They call themselves saltwater people because they live on the coast. And you know, Capes is a really great guy, really very friendly and very easy to get along with, and is very open with his culture and his people. And it's a really fascinating insight into a side of Australia that even a lot of Australians really don't appreciate well.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's a really great day out.
Mm.
Guys, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure as always.
Yep,
if you would like to follow Georgia, you can check her out on Instagram, Georgia Rickard. And to find out more about Sue's books, you can find suewilliams.com. And, of course, suewilliams.com.au. And, of course, to read any great travel stories, you can find them on traveller.com.au. To subscribe to Fly to Fancy, you can find us on iTunes or your favourite podcasting app. And don't forget to rate and review while you're there. And we'll see you next time on Fly to Fancy. Thanks for listening to this podcast, brought to you by Intrepid Travel. Sign up to the Intrepid e-newsletter for more travel inspiration and to be the first to hear about great deals and competitions. Visit intrepidtravel.com to subscribe today.
Flight of Fancy, the traveller.com.au podcast, is hosted by Ben Groundwater, produced by me, Annie Dang, recorded by Shannon Browning, and mixed by Lap Fam. Our digital editor is Craig Platt.